The Word of Mouth Daily Podcast is brought to you by
Doucette Survey,
serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England,
now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine.
Information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com. And
Dartmouth Hitchcock,
creating a new model for healthcare,
where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system
improving the health of our communities
for years to come.
Information at imagine.d-h.
Word of mouth.
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 Word of
mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. After last week's shooting in Chattanooga, a gun control group backed by former New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg launched a series of ads urging lawmakers to adopt stricter background checks for gun buyers. The group, optimistically called Every Town for Gun Safety, was launched with the intent of tightening gun control laws in a nation deeply conflicted over the issue. Support for both sides is fiercely emotional, but the gun rights movement is so politically well-connected that tighter control laws rarely make it past the petitioning stage. The similarities to the recent fight for marriage equality are not lost on the activists on the front lines of the issue. New York Magazine's Lisa Miller discovered that gun control activists are now cribbing tactics and key players from the marriage equality movement and hoping for similar results. Lisa Miller, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Really, really happy to be here. Thanks.
So after decades of fighting for same-sex marriage, you spoke with some of the activists who are now looking to gun control as the next big issue. How are they looking at these issues as similar?
Well, I mean, I just want to say, you know, one of the funny, bittersweet things about the marriage movement, right, is that the victory was so definitive that a lot of the activists who have been spending all of their time fighting for marriage are now out of a job. And so they're looking around for what to do next, and they're being courted by every left cause that you can imagine. But yes, gun control, anti-gun violence is one of the things that they're looking at as having possible analogies to marriage and using their skills that they learned in the marriage movement and applying them to guns.
So what are some of the similarities that they're looking at? I mean, two entrenched populations, you know, the pro-gun, anti-gun, it seems that way in America anyway.
Right. I mean, pro-gun, anti-gun, and more than that, it's that whether you're pro or anti says something really deep about who you are, like what your values are, what you believe freedom is, what you believe it means to be an American, both strongly held and perhaps not entirely thought through emotional feelings about these issues. And what marriage did right was to go to the opponents and sort of force people to think about why they held the feelings that they did hold and force them to reexamine them in a sort of non-threatening, empathetic way. And that really worked for marriage.
Mm-hmm. Well, you make the point that a decade ago, you know, talking about moving the needle on gay marriage was almost unthinkable. Where is public opinion over gun control today?
It's very complicated. Fewer people own guns than ever before, about a third of people. But the people who do own guns own many of them. So it used to be that about half Americans had a gun and they usually had one. Now a third have them and they have, you know, more than two. So gun sales are up, gun owners are down. But the thing that's very complicated is that growing numbers of Americans believe that having a gun in the house will make them safer. Now, all data refute this. It's not safer to have a gun in the house. But there is something very fragile and very emotional about this mindset where people think, you know, I need to have a gun, or what if something happens? I'm going to want to have a gun. And so any threat to this is sort of a threat to a person's sense of safety. And that's where the new anti-gun violence activists want to go. They want to go right to that sense of safety.
So there is a similarity between the maybe visceral, emotional, possibly even irrational sense of gun control battle that compares to the marriage equality battle. How are they different, though? How are they distinct?
Well, you know, the opponents to same-sex marriage were very vocal, and they were very well organized. So in that way, they're similar. The way in which they're different is that politicians didn't necessarily have to have a very firm public stance on the issue. It wasn't, you know, necessarily a first-tier platform issue. And more important, their campaigns weren't funded by a very powerful, well-financed lobby, which is absolutely true in the case of guns, right? So, I mean, what the gun activists say is that politicians have to come out very forcefully for guns because so many of their campaigns are funded by the gun lobby. And that wasn't true of marriage. And on guns, the politicians' opinions don't necessarily reflect popular opinion. So there's a disconnect there, which was not true in marriage. So there's a kind of more layered, what I say in the story is sort of more neurotic American disconnect, dissonance on guns, right? We want to own guns. Our politicians are very captivated by the gun lobby. Fewer of us do own guns. Those of us who own guns own more of them. We're not very clear with ourselves about where we stand on guns, although we hold our beliefs very, very passionately. I think gay marriage was a much simpler pro or con issue. Mm. And there wasn't this disconnect between what our politicians were saying and what we, the voters, were saying.
We're talking with Lisa Miller, and she spoke to several gun control activists who are hoping to apply the successful tactics of the marriage equality movement to fight for stricter gun laws. For a long time, it was somewhat political kryptonite for politicians to talk about gay marriage. President Obama, in his first and second campaigns, wasn't going to touch it. When did the messaging actually shift on gay marriage, do you think, publicly?
The activists know exactly when it shifted, and it shifted around 2010, 2011. And it was when those activists started talking about marriage, not as a right and not legalistically or as a policy priority, but as an emotional issue. And that's where the similarity to guns can come in. You know, they started talking about marriage as love and commitment and respect and sort of appealing to opponents and saying, like, don't we all deserve love? Don't we all want commitment? Don't we all deserve respect? And that was something very, very hard to push against. I think that empathy, I think taking opponents where they are and taking their discomfort seriously and addressing it straight on instead of calling people, you know, stupid or unsophisticated or whatever name-calling was happening until that point, and saying, look, you know, gay people, they're like you. They want the same things you want. They want family stability. They want to be able to visit each other in the hospital. Isn't that what you want for your family? I think that messaging change was the pivot point mm-hmm. in America, and allowed people, even opponents, to sort of look at the thing through a totally new lens and have it be okay for them. And so on guns, right, if you convince people that forget about whether you have the right to own a gun or not, forget about the Second Amendment, we're not going to talk about that. We're going to say, don't we all want guns not to be in the hands of people who shouldn't have them? Don't we all want our children and our neighborhoods and our families to be safer? So if you can change the conversation to, like, let's all keep our kids safe, instead of, you know, I have a right to own guns versus you guys are stupid, it will be a much more productive conversation.
Well, and if you're talking about messaging and keeping the consistency in messaging, focusing on, you know, love, commitment, family, that kind of thing that they did in the gay marriage debate, have you seen the language or messaging change after the shooting in Chattanooga last week?
You know, it's funny because I wrote this story before the shooting in Chattanooga, and I was just looking at it as we were talking. It has 300 comments, and the comments are so vitriolic on both sides. Mm-hmm. You know, you can wish for a change in messaging. And I think it's true that the gun groups are getting more coherent on the messaging. But among the people, the warfare in the trenches is just as violent and vitriolic, it seems to me, as it ever has been.
Well, I'm thinking community, safety, responsibility, protecting my family. Wouldn't it be just as easy for the pro-gun rights lobby to tear a page from this strategy and say...
Well, you know, I mean, ironically, what was beautiful about the marriage messaging and what could be beautiful about the gun messaging, if it does work, is that the left borrows the language from the right and redefines it. So in marriage, the right, the opponents to same-sex marriage, were using words like love and commitment and respect. And the left went and said, no, you know, these are all of our values. And same thing with the gun lobby. Like, the gun lobby says owning a gun will keep you safer. And what the anti-gun activists are now saying is, let's use this idea of safety as more of a community responsibility word instead of a owning a gun word and see if we can make that stick.
Well, what do you think, Lisa Miller? Is there a new activist playbook based on the fight for equal marriage?
Definitely. I definitely think there is one. And, you know, after years of doing this, I actually think that listening to the concerns of your opponents and hearing them and addressing them with empathy is a really good way to turn the tide and change the conversation.
Lisa Miller, she's contributing editor at New York Magazine. Thank you very much for speaking with us.
My pleasure.
To her article, The Gun Control Movement is Borrowing the Marriage Equality Playbook and Hoping for Similar Results is online, and we do have a link to it at wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Early in the 20th century, the Los Angeles Police Department was one of the most corrupt in all of America. But in 1950, a new police chief entered the scene with the intent of putting all the bad press behind them and restoring policing as an honorable profession. Backstory producer Nina Ernest brings us the story.
Each week at this point in our program, On the Beat, we bring to our microphone a special guest. Tonight, we are especially proud to present the new chief executive of the Los Angeles Police Department, Chief of Police William H. Parker.
He was an intimidating, cold SOB.
This is John Bunton, who wrote a biography of Parker. Consider this. One of Parker's former speechwriters, Gene Roddenberry, went on to create a little show called Star Trek, and it turns out that Steely Dr. Spock is, in part, based on Parker.
But envision a Spock who was also an alcoholic. Cerebral, cold, intense, formidable.
Vulcan tendencies aside, Parker was seen as an upstanding cop. He was a war hero and veteran officer who developed the department's first Bureau of Internal Affairs, investigating all manner of police misconduct.
He had the reputation of being incorruptible.
This is historian Edward Escobar.
And of having very precise ideas of how policing should work. And those precise ideas were around the issue of professionalism.
Police professionalism didn't begin with Parker, but he was a standout warrior for the cause. Beginning in the 1920s, reformers came to believe that the way to root out corrupt cops was to treat policing like a profession, as something respectable. So in Parker's mind, fighting crime required just as much expertise as becoming a lawyer or a doctor.
And Parker and the police professionalism movement believed that they needed to be the sole arbiters of who became a police officer and who should discipline police officers if they stepped out of bounds.
To stop corruption in the force, Parker had to make sure that cops, and cops alone, controlled the department. But there's more to the story of professionalism and the LAPD than just autonomy.
One of the ideas of being a professional, say, now let's turn to medicine for a second, is that you have to have a theory of what causes illness, what causes disease. Well, in the same way, police had to have an idea of what causes crime and then what they should be doing to fight crime.
And in L.A., that meant focusing their often violent crime-fighting efforts on the city's Mexican-American community. Theories about minorities being prone to criminality still influenced police behavior. By the time Parker took control, the LAPD's tactics in minority neighborhoods had led to tensions between the cops and the people they policed. Those tactics set the scene for what would become a real threat to Parker's prized autonomy. It was Christmas Eve, 1951. That night, two officers were called to the Showboat Bar on report of underage drinking.
So these two officers show up. There are seven people there. The officers ask for some ID. Five of the seven men were Latinos. Two were Anglos. No one's a minor. But instead of leaving the scene, the police officers tell several of the guys to disperse.
Police officers brutally tried to throw them out of the bar. A fight ensued. The seven young men overpowered the police officers and left the scene.
And then in the middle of the night, the police came for them. You know, 4 a.m. in the morning, people started being dragged out of their beds.
That's when six of the young men were taken into custody at the LAPD Central Division, where LA's finest were having a Christmas party.
Now, a rumor had spread within the department that the police officers had been badly beaten and that one of them had actually lost an eye.
That wasn't true. But true or not, the cops wanted revenge. Fueled by anger and copious amounts of alcohol, things got ugly really fast.
Remember the scene from L.A. Confidential? That actually happened.
This is for ours, Poncho.
It's estimated that around 50 officers took turns severely beating these young men in their cells.
What are you looking at? What are you looking at?
You would think that in a professional police department that when something like that occurred, William H. Parker would know about it immediately and start an investigation of what would happen and then would go in and discipline the officers for such a breach of discipline. That did not happen.
Instead, the public didn't hear about the case until March, when the young men went to trial and told their side of the story. The press dubbed the incident Bloody Christmas. Rumors spread that the mayor would ask for Parker's resignation, and the chief suddenly found his department under the scrutiny of a grand jury investigation. Mexican-American groups and others who had long suffered at the hands of the cops fought to bring the officers and Parker to justice. Critics wanted more civilian oversight of the force, and opponents wanted to revoke the section of the city charter that gave the department independence in personnel issues.
What Bloody Christmas posed was this problem of brutality and accountability. You know, you have a police chief who wants to free the police department from corruption. Look at Los Angeles's history. That's understandable. But at what point do you also free the department from accountability?
Parker fought this threat to autonomy any way he could. He stonewalled the grand jury. He also launched a PR campaign pushing the idea that the police were the thin blue line protecting civilized society from anarchy. And on top of that, Parker had the upper hand in the court of public opinion, thanks in part to this. The wildly popular radio-turned-television show Dragnet started long before Parker took the helm of the LAPD. But he understood the value of good publicity and maintained a very close working relationship with the show. Listen closely, and you'll catch Parker's name in the credits.
Technical advice comes from the Office of Chief of Police W.H. Parker, Los Angeles Police Department.
At the same time, the newspapers were putting out this image of the LAPD as a rampaging, brutal, unaccountable organization. You know, people were seeing a very different image of the LAPD. The LAPD as ultra-efficient, bureaucratic machine. And, you know, that was a vision that the population of Los Angeles in general was happy to, you know, sign off on.
In the end, 8 officers were indicted for using excessive force, and 5 were convicted. That was unprecedented in LA. But Parker kept his job, and no structural changes were made to the police department's autonomous status. Parker tightened his grip on the department, and under his leadership, the LAPD would go on to become a model professional police force. But now, no one was policing that professional force. And Escobar says that left the city's minority communities with very few options in the face of continued mistreatment.
The outcomes were the Watts riots of 1965. You have an ongoing simmering conflict between the LAPD and the Black and Mexican-American communities throughout the next decades, culminating, if you will, with the Rodney King beating of the early 1990s and the subsequent riots. This became sort of a cancer that consumed the department from the inside out.
It wasn't until the 1999 Rampart scandal, involving brutality and the framing of suspects, that authorities said enough was enough. After 50 years, it was time to protect this most professional of organizations from its own criminal elements.
And that was producer Nina Easton from the podcast Backstory with the American History Guys. You can find a link to hear it again at wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. This month marks the 200th anniversary of Napoleon's defeat at Waterloo. The fallen emperor was then exiled to St. Helena, a tiny British protectorate 1,200 miles off the South African coast. Napoleon lived out his days on the remote island he called this Cursed Rock and died there in 1821. Today, St. Helena remains one of the most inaccessible places on Earth. The only link to the outside world is a mail and supply boat that comes in from Cape Town every 3 weeks. That is until a British government-funded airport opens in the spring of 2016. The filmmaker Dieter Deswarte made a short film about life on the island for the BBC. He's currently working on a feature-length documentary. And Dieter, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you.
To get an idea of how isolated St. Helena is, it's 1,200 miles from the South African coast, 1,800 miles from Brazil, so very much out there in the middle of the Atlantic, and now even more isolated than it was in the past. Is that true?
Yes, it's much more isolated now, because I think early on it was really at the beginning of colonization, and lots of ships used to pass by as they stocked up on food and traveled on, and it was a very important place, like, that connected the United Kingdom to the rest of the world. But since the collapse of the East India Company, when it was handed over to the British Crown Company, and also since the opening of the Suez Canal, ships had no reason anymore to pass by St. Helena, so it's been much more pushed back into isolation in the last 100 years.
How did you get to St. Helena?
Well, I traveled on 3 occasions to St. Helena. So there's 2 ways to travel to St. Helena. One way is to fly to Cape Town, and from Cape Town, you then take a boat that takes 5 days, and then you arrive. And that ship leaves, as you said, almost once a month. The other way to get there is an opportunity. There's 10 passenger tickets with the British military flying to Ascension Island. And from there, you can take the boat as well, which kind of makes a round trip. It goes from Cape Town to St. Helena to Ascension Island, and then back to Cape Town again. And the journey from Ascension Island is 2.5 days. But as there's only one flight a week to Ascension Island, it often is still faster to go via Cape Town.
How many people currently live there?
At the moment, there's about 4,500 people living there, and that's 4,000 St. Helenians, and there would be around 400 expatriates.
And they call themselves saints?
Yes, they do.
Tell us a little bit about their origins.
Well, their origins are mixed, because they are very much, there's Chinese roots, there's Malaysian roots, there's African roots, there's Scottish roots, Irish roots. It's a melting pot of all different kinds of cultures. Mm-hmm. But most of those cultures are not present anymore. As it is so small, the only culture that was able to kind of survive was almost the British one.
Yeah, so these people, many of them were sailors and settlers and slaves. I imagine when the East India Company pulled out, a lot of people pulled out. What's happened to the population of the island?
Well, after the East India Company left, I think a lot of people who would have had money, in a sense, would have left, as there was not much more for them to do there anymore, as less and less ships were coming. And I think over the years, it was only the people who couldn't leave that were left behind, really.
So it was declared a British dependent territory in 1981. How much do these saints rely on Britain?
Oh, they rely on it very heavily. For me, it's always been very obvious that for a long time it has been a colony. although there were no indigenous people, it was still very much quite an oppressive place in a sense where it was ruled by the governor. For a long time, there was not really a council. Since I think the 80s, there's been a local council who decides most things. But there's still a governor that needs to be British-born on the island. And not only that, but also in terms of aid, there's always been quite an importance to the United Kingdom. They cannot support themselves financially. So there's a real sort of sense that they are dependent financially upon the United Kingdom for maintaining the island and sort of all basic needs.
What does it feel like being on the island of St. Helena? It's a setup for a place that's living in the past.
Yes, definitely. And although I always am very cautious with this idea of living in the past, but you do feel that time sort of has slowed down on St. Helena a little bit. And you see a lot of sort of quaint British traditions as the Boy Scouts passing by every week and a lot of things that British people could feel nostalgic to in a way. It's also strange, obviously, that they don't have any mobile phones. So there's no easy way to contact anybody. You rely on landlines again, and that's supposed to be changing. Your internet is quite slow, very costly. And you do really feel the sense of once the ship leaves that you're stuck. There's no more getting off. And that can feel really strange. I remember before leaving there, shooting a film, I was so worried of forgetting some equipment, because once you're there, I can't go get it anywhere. And the biggest issue comes in, obviously, in healthcare. What happens if you get seriously ill? And although they can treat a lot in the local hospital, but there's certain things that they can't deal with, brain tumors, heart surgery. You know, you need to be sent off to Cape Town for treatment, and then you still have to wait for that ship.
Right, and that's a five-day trip right now. About to be, if everything goes according to plan, a new airport there, which will make it a five-hour trip from Cape Town. In 2011, the British government announced it's going to be investing in an airport on the island. So what is Britain hoping for by putting in an airport?
For it to become a not-so-financially dependent territory. I think that would be sort of the main motivation. It's also obviously to help the island itself. But as at the moment, the British government invests £25 million a year into St. Helena, it's quite a lot of money for such a small island. And I think there's some sort of aim that they say, well, we give you all this money now, and then over the course of 10 years, every year, we're going to give you a bit less money. And the idea is that you can develop an economy around tourism.
So they're investing right now about $400 million US in this airport. Any other kind of tourism infrastructure investments being made there?
That has been a difficulty. Slowly it's becoming like they are starting to build some hotels, and also some local people have started to invest in building some things, buying fishing boats that mm-hmm. they can take tourists on. But it's still all very uncertain because nobody's sure if any tourists will really show up. I think in the long term, they're aiming to get 30,000 tourists a year, which is a lot more than what they have now. But the infrastructure is not really ready at the moment. And there's a lot of ideas, good ideas around a sort of more sustainable future for the island. But naturally, it all comes with a lot of risks. And they need foreign investment to come in for the island to be able to grow. But what kind of foreign investment do you take upon, and how much choice will you have?
So the government is making this big decision and this big investment. How do people who live on the island feel? Their way of life is about to change, it sounds like, dramatically if they get 30,000 tourists a year.
Well, it is dramatic. And I think a lot of people can't also still imagine maybe quite yet like how it is going to be like. And potentially it won't change that much, but then that's another big problem because then there's still no employment on the island. The main problem as well at the moment is that wages are very low and people who don't have that much find no other way than maybe having to move offshore and get a job for the American military on Ascension Island or on the Falkland Islands where the British military is. And obviously, tourism can help people to develop a better standard of living, but it's also a big risk because that peace and tranquility that so many saints value, that sense of home and a home that is not necessarily linked to a commercial home, changes as well.
Well, you know, for a number of former British colonies or even British protectorates, there's a long shadow of colonialism. There are big divisions in ethnicity or race or in class. Does that exist on the tiny island, St. Helena?
I think it exists like anywhere else in the world in a way. It exists less and smaller, but it's still present in some way. And you will always have the people who are a bit less well off and also due to family relations won't have had so many chances. And there are a few families who've always been sort of well-established families, who've been there quite a long time, who own a lot of property. The tensions are less visible, but in a way, they are definitely still present. It's really hard living on such a small island in such a small community because everybody knows everything about mm-hmm. everybody. Mm-hmm. And that becomes really challenging because you feel that although everybody's very friendly and quite sort of helpful, it's also really hard because you know people are easily talking about you or know what you did or who you slept with or how your job is going or what you did wrong at the job. And people are just kind of fearful as well about speaking up about what's wrong in their lives and what's not going well. There's, I think, called an Australian concept, which they call the tall poppy syndrome, which is the idea as well when you try to do something different in a small community like this, it's very difficult because other people try and pull you down.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the islanders that you did interview told you that St. Helena loses isolation when the airplane lands. The magnitude is going to be distinct. What do you think that change is going to mean in 5 years down the road?
In 5 years down the road, I think, I hope that the island and the people living there will have found a way to deal with their complex past and sort of feel more free and openly to speak with one another. And also I hope that they will be economically a bit more settled, but not exploited.
Well, Dieter, thank you very much for speaking with us today.
You're welcome.
Dieter Deswarte, he's a filmmaker. He's based in London and he's currently working on a feature-length documentary film about the tiny island of St. Helena, which is about to get an airport and hopefully, or not, a booming tourist industry. The working title of the film is Saints. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. It is summer vacation season, and for some lucky families, that means visiting the most desirable spots in the world. So what happens when, despite all of your careful planning, you land in the middle of a political or economic crisis? So, Steph, where are you going in Greece?
Well, we're going to fly into Athens, obviously, spend a couple of days with my father. Then we head down to the Peloponnese and to go around to Sparta and Olympia, which is where we have family villages. And then we'll go over to an island, a nice little island that not too many people go to, so I'm not going to tell you the name of it. Is that okay?
That's fantastic. And that is Steph Katsonis. He's a journalist and former CNN reporter now living near Boston. While there has been continued coverage on the Greek debt crisis, referendum, and subsequent deal with the EU, little attention has been paid to how the crisis is affecting Greece's lively tourism industry, fully 17% of the nation's GDP last year. Andreas Andreadis is president of the Greek Tourism Confederation. Here he is speaking with Guy Johnson of Bloomberg News in early July.
Are you seeing cancellations at this point? What's the sort of the last minute story as well?
Well, very few cancellations. People have planned. Of course, they ask questions. They ask how is the reality. I mean, everything works normally. Airports, ports, transportation, hotels. There's enough food, drinks, everything. So for the moment, you know, all is okay. Obviously, few people are worried and they want to cancel, but this is a very, very small percentage.
Incredibly, the numbers back him up. Despite the financial uncertainty of these past few months, travel to Greece is up by 2%, in part because there are other parts of the world that are even more turbulent. London's Daily Mail reported that the June terrorist attacks at a hotel in Tunisia, for example, had vacation companies scrambling to redirect clients, many of whom are now headed to Greece. It does look like things are a bit more stable since Greece made its payment to the IMF yesterday. Banks have reopened, but with restrictions on how much money Greeks can withdraw, and the likelihood of food shortages and demonstrations continues. Well, we wanted to know whether Steph, who goes back to visit family in Greece once every few years, is doing anything differently to prepare for his trip this summer. We spoke to him just after the Greek parliament voted on reform measures to secure a European bailout.
So my assumption was, because of all the stories you've heard, that there's not going to be any cash to be had. I called my father, asked him if he'd have any to lend me and I could give him dollars when he next came here. And he said that I'm short. I didn't take any money out of the bank before this all happened, but your aunt did take a bunch of cash and she's shoving it under her mattress in her little remote country home. Oh boy, oh boy, that's not a good idea. And that he could get some from her. I was figuring I'd grab a bunch of, like, a couple of $1,000 in euros and maybe a grand in dollars too, just in case the euro really dropped a lot or it got so bad that there was some kind of a black market opening up in dollars. So then I just emailed a couple of friends or called a couple of friends today. One of them said it's really gotten better since the news got better, that tourists can get all the cash they need on credit cards and that the fees aren't so bad. Then I also emailed my friend Malcolm Brabant. Yeah, I don't know if you've ever heard of him. He's a BBC correspondent who knows Greece super well and was just there now. And he emailed me back the following, quote, "Don't take wads of cash with you. The ATMs are dishing money out to foreign cards. And now Parliament has agreed to the deal, there won't be a problem for a while. People have been getting robbed in Crete. So take maybe a grand in dollars just as emergency money."
What does it feel like if you're a foreigner and you walk up to a bank that people are waiting, you know, Greeks, locals are waiting in long lines to get into and you just saunter in and get cash?
Yeah. Well, the thing is you won't just saunter in because they'll give you a filthy look if you try and jump the queue. But it's true. And in fact, that was one of the warnings I got from one of my friends that he said you'll have an easier time getting the cash in the tourist areas out in the islands than in the city neighborhoods in Athens, let's say, because that's where there's just people standing there all day long and you'll waste a couple of hours just till you get to the machine. Sure, it wouldn't feel good. I'm not there now, so I don't know if there's a mood of resentment or not. I used to be a reporter overseas going to war zones. We used to carry money bags full with like $40,000 in cash, $60,000 in cash. My top stash was $140,000 in $100 bills flying into Somalia. So I think that way. I think you need to carry cash, but you also have to be very careful about walking around with it and where you leave it. And
well, you also are bringing your kids. You were at all worried about civil unrest. If, as predictions have it, there soon will be food shortages and the shelves will thin out and people will get a little bit more desperate.
See, this is the thing. I mean, as somebody who used to live there and knows the place, there's the known and there's the unknown. Known to me is that, oh yeah, there'll be demonstrations, there'll be Molotov cocktails around the Polytechnic. That's what the young anarchist, quote-unquote, group kids do. It's almost sport, practically. It's been going on for years on and off. So that's the known. And if that's all that goes on, I know how to keep the kids away from that. It's not even hard. If it's really getting bad by the time we're there, I mean, really, people are hurting. Then it's the unknown. You don't know what comes next.
Did you ever consider canceling your trip?
No.
What has your father said about being there throughout all the unrest, the referendum, the follow-up, the uncertainty, and now what looks to be like a capitulation of sorts?
Well, the thing you have to keep in mind with my father is that my father's an old man, so he's sort of withdrawing in a way mentally. And I've asked him a few times and have been sort of surprised that he hasn't got more to tell me. But I talked to him, I talked to my cousins down in the village, and I think what I come away with is that it's this sort of, it's almost like there's two realities at once. He has lost a lot of his nest egg over the course of a few years and is actually kind of worried that he won't have enough to fund his remaining years on this earth. But now, you know, he's still well off enough that he can walk around and it's only a matter of a cash flow problem for him. On the other hand, I talked to my cousins down in the village and they're seriously hurting and they've been seriously hurting for several years now. One example is that my little old aunt lives very humbly, and I mean really humbly. She cooks up a little couple of pieces of chicken and rice and all that stuff, cooks them wonderfully, but it's humble living. Her house, she can rent out rooms to tourists. So a couple of years ago, my aunt was ordered by the government to cough up 25,000 euros in tax money.
So that must have been like $40,000 a couple of years ago.
33,000 approximately, 32, mm-hmm. somewhere there. But a lady like that does not have that kind of cash. She's probably never had that kind of cash in the bank. And she just can't cough that up. Now, I think in the end, people just couldn't, and somehow the government gave in a little bit. But this is the kind of dilemma they face. The country's trying to squeeze blood from a stone, and the little people are really hurting.
And that was Steph Katsonis. He's a journalist and radio producer living near Boston. He and his wife and two sons are heading to Greece for vacation this week. Austerity does appear to be a very tough road, and as we heard, especially for those at the bottom of the economy. But from here, it appears that there would be worse places to tighten one's belt or just chuck it off altogether than the white cliffs and turquoise seas of a Greek island, a fantasy of Greek life that may well be part of the problem. Climate change introduces a host of challenges. With rising tides and changing coastlines already eating away at landmass, scientists, NGOs, and industries are modeling responses to significant rises in sea levels. A company called the Ocean Reef Group is experimenting with how to plant a garden when there's no dry land to be found. The company's testing underwater greenhouses off the coast of Italy. Rob Gabelhoff wrote about underwater greenhouses for the Washington Post Speaking of Science blog. And Robert, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you.
So how does an underwater greenhouse work?
Well, it's a pretty interesting concept. The place is called Nemo's Garden. What they do is they produce balloon-like biospheres just about 20 feet under the ocean, trap the sunlight into these areas so that they're able to concentrate that light on the plants. But it also has constant temperatures because the ocean is a constant temperature. And it also is, you know, free from the regular predators that plants would have, like insects.
How big are they?
Usually it's about the size of a small dome that you might find in like a small greenhouse in your backyard.
Sort of like a hoop house kind of thing, except completely sealed.
Yeah.
Do they get enough sun and enough oxygen?
Yes, they get about the same sun that any other plant would get. But they also have higher pressure for carbon dioxide. As the scientists told me, it's almost as if it's putting them on steroids to make them grow faster, but naturally.
And how about salination? I mean, they're not getting water. They're getting what, moisturized?
Right. Because it's a balloon shape, the surface of the water is at the bottom of the greenhouse. It evaporates with the sun and comes to the top of the greenhouse, and that trickles down to the plants and waters them.
How much can be grown in these greenhouses?
Well, that's a tough question because they're also prone to have to deal with the atmosphere and the weather of the ocean. Sometimes tough storms can knock these out. But from what they've said, they've been able to produce quite a bit of produce.
What sort of crops are being grown in these underwater greenhouses?
Mostly basil, but they've also experimented with strawberries. They've done some beans, and they're looking to do some mushrooms.
There's a company behind this, the Ocean Reef Group. What's the motivation for them?
They're really just doing this for the pure science of it, putting together the research and development for this type of technology themselves, even though they're a very small company. It was inspired by the president of the company, Sergio Gamberini. He came up with this idea when he was on vacation in Italy one day. It's a very interesting concept.
Great things can come out of Italian vacations.
Yes.
Is this something that we could reasonably see grow past the experimental stage?
I think there is potential, and they seem to think so, too. They have big, grand ideas of pulling this into developing countries to help them grow crops in areas that they wouldn't be able to otherwise. It very possibly could once they get it nailed down.
Well, Robert Gabelhoff, thank you for telling us about this.
Yeah, no problem. I'm happy to talk about it.
Robert Gabelhoff, he's a science reporter for The Washington Post, and he wrote about the underwater greenhouse off the coast of Italy. You can see more at wordofmouthradio.org. Thanks so much for your listening time today. There is much more to hear and to explore at wordofmouthradio.org. And if you missed any of today's show, you can catch it in its entirety with the Word of Mouth podcast. There is a link to subscribe at wordofmouthradio.org or by searching Word of Mouth NHPR in iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you enjoy it, please tell a friend and pass it around. After all, the best suggestions travel by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. Please join us for more Word of Mouth tomorrow at 2 here on New Hampshire Public Radio.